Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Switzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of publications that appear in the June 2021 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Michael L. McManus. Dr. McManus is the first author of an article titled Availability of Inpatient Pediatric Surgery in the United States. Dr. McManus is Associate Professor, Department of Anesthesiology, Critical Care and Pain Medicine, Division of Critical Care at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dr. McManus.
Hi, Dr. Switzer. Thanks for inviting me today.
And joining Dr. McManus is Dr. Alan J. Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz wrote an accompanying editorial, Availability of Pediatric Surgery, Implications for Planning Pediatric Anesthesiology Education. Dr. Schwartz is Professor of Clinical Anesthesiology and Critical Care, Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania, and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, both in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Dr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Dr. Switzer. I'm very glad to be part of this podcast with Dr. McManus and you.
Let's start with you, Dr. McManus. What was the aim of your study?
Well, for some time, my co-author, Dr. Franca, and I have been interested in the regionalization and consolidation of pediatric hospital care. As an anesthesiologist working for many years in a children's hospital, my clinical impression is that less and less routine pediatric surgery is being done in the community. And over the last decade or so, there's been a growing literature on this, but it tends to focus on specific procedures or surgical specialties in specific regions. So we wanted to try and get a more complete picture of what was going on by looking at all children and all procedures across the country.
So how did you go about doing this study?
Well, to capture all procedures in all acute care hospitals, we use state inpatient databases from the Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project, also known as HCUP. These are all encounter files that capture all hospitalizations within a state, including all patients and all payers. So then we looked deeply into several states to see what kinds of procedures were being done in what kinds of hospitals, and included all therapeutic procedures of all kinds, even minor ones that didn't require anesthesia. And after getting a sense of what was going on within some individual states, we used the kid inpatient data set, also from HCUP, to see if the findings there might be true nationally.
But Dr. Schwartz, we define childhood across a broad age range. However, do children of all ages benefit from specialized pediatric care?
I certainly believe they do. All patients, and that certainly includes children of all ages, benefit from specialized care. The idea that specialized anesthesia care is essential for pediatric principles was the principal assertion of the 1997 editorial by Rockoff and Hall. That editorial became one of the reasons why there was an establishment of pediatric anesthesiology fellowship training. A modern statement of this idea was presented by Atul Gawande in his book, Complications. He noted that, quote, Western medicine is dominated by a single imperative, the quest for perfection in delivery of care. The keys to this kind of perfection are routinization and repetition.
Dr. McManus, can you tell us more about the 2016 Kids Inpatient Database that you drew upon for this study of yours?
The Kids Inpatient Database is the largest publicly available all-payer pediatric inpatient data source in America. It contains information from about 3 million discharges that are sampled to permit estimates regarding about 7 million in total. It's very powerful in analyzing trends or making national estimates, And some listeners may be familiar with HCUP statistical briefs, which often rely on it for reports on national healthcare topics related to kids.
So I understand, though, because of some limitations of the KID database, you had to use a second analysis. So first, can you tell us why this KID database was not sufficient for your purposes and what next steps you took?
Well, as great as it is, the KID does have some limitations. First, it's only available every 3 years. Second, it's a sample, not a complete data set, so it's only intended to yield estimates and can miss low-frequency events. But third, and most importantly for our purposes here, the KID doesn't specify states or individual hospitals, doesn't identify them. So it can tell us what procedures or admissions are in hospitals across the whole country, but not which ones are where. So we try to get the best of both worlds by deriving procedure and hospital details from some state data sets and then using the KID to see if the state numbers seem to generalize nationally.
Quite creative. Dr. Schwartz, isn't it a good thing to concentrate surgical procedures in high-volume places with surgeons who do a lot of these cases?
It certainly is. Concentrating procedures in high-volume places where surgeons do a lot of pediatric cases has multiple advantages. These include the fact that all people caring for the children, surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, pharmacists, to name a few, and all the medications and equipment specific for pediatric patients, and lastly, all the protocols specific for safe care of pediatric patients exist in these places where concentrated surgical procedures are done for pediatric patients. That allows people to become familiar with routine for more effective, efficient, and safe care.
Dr. McManus, I think you look more closely at data for pediatric surgery in six individual states. Why did you choose only six, and why the six that you picked?
Well, we were looking for a broad picture, so wanted to look at a range of states with different populations and different urban-rural compositions, different geographies, different health system structures. And then we also wanted to make sure to include some states with and some without children's hospitals, and some with and without a lot of academic medical centers, and states with different numbers of hospital referral regions. So we settled on the six states here because they seem to offer a really excellent mix of these characteristics while themselves accounting for about 17% of all children in the United States.
What were the six states?
Arkansas, Florida, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Maryland, and New York.
Those kind of missed the West, right?
Yeah, there's been some whole study states on California, and the populations were kind of sparse in a lot of the other states. So we've since followed up with others, and what I'm talking about here and in the paper are true pretty much everywhere.
So can you tell us approximately how many encounters and how many different hospitals you found from all of these sources?
Well, from the KID, as I said, there are about 3 million encounters sampled from 7 million admissions, and those are within about 4,200 hospitals. In our study states, we were able to look in detail at more than 1 million admissions with just over 700 hospitals. And among those hospitals, there were 6 freestanding children's hospitals, 33 large general hospitals that functioned like pediatric referral centers or children's hospitals in their regions, 9 specialty hospitals, and about 470 community hospitals. So for shorthand, we refer to the 48 children's, specialty, and pediatric referral hospitals as high-capability centers to collectively distinguish them from typical community hospitals.
Can you give me an example of what you refer to as a specialty hospital?
We have the states that I mentioned, so a good example might be the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, which does ear, nose, and throat operations in kids and ophthalmologic operations in kids. Also, Sloan Kettering, which does cancer and things like that.
Got it. So Dr. Schwartz, do children, regardless of medical conditions and types of surgeries, have better outcomes if cared for by a pediatric anesthesiologist? Do we have that data? What do we know about how these variables all line up, I guess?
So there's a substantial amount of evidence that indicates that anesthesia is more complex in younger patients. Anesthetic complications increase as patient age decreases. Data from the Pediatric Perioperative Cardiac Arrest Registry indicates the most frequent causes of anesthesia-related cardiac arrests in children are cardiovascular, and that means unrecognized or untreated hypovolemia. And that accounts for about 41% of pediatric cardiac arrests under anesthesia, and that's followed by respiratory causes. And these are primarily in the PACU, in the post-anesthesia recovery period, and that accounts for about 20% of all respiratory arrests. Moray reported that more than half of all anesthesia-related cardiac arrests occur in children younger than 1 year of age. In 1991, Keenan and his colleagues found a significant increase in major complications for infants who were anesthetized by non-pediatric anesthesiologists. Another study, Stoddard's, identified that a major problem of occasional pediatric anesthesia practice is for the anesthetist to remain up to date with their skills. After a national quality assurance study based on voluntary reporting of more than 20,000 surgical and anesthesia-related deaths, 417 of which occurred in children under 10 years of age, that raised concerns about the absence of skilled pediatric anesthesiologists, anesthetists in some specialty units. Investigators in England recommended that surgeons and anesthesiologists do not do occasional pediatric cases, since the outcome of the surgery and anesthesia in children is related to the experience of the clinician involved. They recommended a minimum caseload of about 200 pediatric anesthetics per provider per year to reduce the incidence of complications. While this is a specific numeric recommendation, others have suggested that setting a minimum case volume is complicated, and obviously the exact number is not easy to define. Intuitively, concentrating procedures in high-volume places where surgeons do a lot of pediatric cases has the advantage of increasing the number of similar cases so that anesthesiologists will achieve a sufficient volume of practice associated with the safer care that we all want for children.
Dr. McManus, what did you find?
In our study states, we found that more than 83% of all procedures of all types, even the superficial ones, were being done in high-capability centers. This fraction varied with age, such that about 90% of procedures among kids under two were in these centers, and about half of the procedures outside these centers were among teenagers. When we compared this to the KID national sample, we found similar concentration across the entire country, with just under 9% of hospitals accounting for about 90% of all pediatric procedures. Again, since we included even very simple procedures, this degree of concentration was impressive.
I think you wrote that half of the hospitals reporting any pediatric procedures reported doing just 12 or fewer, while three-quarters reported 45 or fewer. And only, I think, around 5% of the hospitals reported more than 1,000 procedures. I find these numbers quite surprising, along with what you just also shared with us. So do you mean that these numbers were total cases or types of cases, like 12 total cases?
Yeah, these were total cases, and yes, we were surprised too. For many hospitals, the case numbers were so low that we initially suspected some kind of artifact. Instead, it seems that the vast majority of hospitals just don't do any pediatric procedures routinely, but may occasionally undertake a few relatively simple procedures in older children.
Hmm. So what were the most common procedures performed in the high-capability facilities?
Many of the most common procedures performed in the high-capability hospitals were what you would think you would find in a referral center. So spinal fusions, cardiac procedures, neurosurgery, large thoracic or abdominal operations, etc. However, almost as many of the procedures were ones that might be considered routine, like appendectomy, tonsillectomy, abscess drainage, things like that.
And what about the opposite situation? What kind of procedures were being done in the non-high capability places?
Well, outside of the high capability centers, there were far fewer cases, and the vast majority did fit your intuition of routine. They were appendectomies, skin and sub-Q INDs, tonsillectomy, fracture reductions, things like that. Occasionally, there were a little bit more significant neonatal procedures being done in hospitals that were maternity centers rather than general pediatric referral centers, but these were a tiny minority.
I want to get to that maternity center and neonatal issue a little later, but first I want to ask, were you able to differentiate between sort of emergency surgeries versus elective? Like, is that why sort of things like appendectomies and skin INDs, maybe it was they couldn't get to a referral center, so they did that more locally?
We couldn't really tell if the cases were emergent other than the nature of the case. So appendectomy is a great example. But that was one kind of procedure that seemed to be still done in a lot of places. Many of the other procedures, not so much, whether they were emergent or not. So testicular torsion and things like that were less done in the community than in the high capability centers.
Is that maybe because, like, adults have appendectomies also, and someone, I guess, who thought a general surgeon, if I can do one on an adult, I can do it on a kid, and testicular torsion is just much more common in kids, and so adult urologists don't see those, or?
Yeah, I think we're still trying to tease some of the motivations out, but we did a study a few years ago or a year and a half ago that we published where we were just looking at abdominal pain in children, and the transfer rates are much, much, much higher now than they used to be, and many, many kids are now being transferred for every abdominal pain, so they'll get to a receiving hospital, usually a tertiary center, and many of them will just be sent home. So I know a lot of kids are being sent out for appendectomies, what end up being appendectomies, and then still, at least in the cases of the hospitals we saw here, there were still appendectomies being done in the community.
So Dr. Schwartz, how many pediatric hospitals with pediatric anesthesiology training programs do we have in the U.S., and are these aligned with pediatric surgery training programs?
Pediatric anesthesiology fellowship training started in the late 90s and early 2000s. You can find the data about these fellowship training programs because it's reported every year in the Journal of the American Medical Association. They publish a yearly medical education issue with data like this. So interestingly, in 2005, the first year that the JAMA reported anesthesiology subspecialty fellowship training, there were 44 programs and 107 trainees. 5 years later, there were two more programs, 46 programs, and 143 trainees, up from the initial report of 100 or 107. Currently, in 2020, there are now 61 pediatric anesthesiology training programs, and they're training 200 fellows. As a point of reference, if you look at total anesthesiology training programs, trainees in all educational programs, in 2005, it was about 4,800. In 2010, 5,300, and now in 2020, there are 6,300, approximately 6,300 trainees. So training in anesthesiology has grown considerably in the last 10 or 15 years, and along with it, the number of pediatric fellowship training programs and trainees. has grown considerably. Over the past 8 years, there's been nearly 150% increase in the fellowship positions. And amazingly, that's been accompanied by an all-time low in the match filling of those programs. In 2019, for example, only 58% of the fellowship spots for pediatric anesthesiology education went filled.
Is that because people aren't interested in those spots, or because they can't find qualified candidates to fill those spots?
There are qualified candidates. I think a lot of the applicants are looking to be in the, as Dr. McManus would say, high-capability centers, the programs where there are concentration of procedures and an opportunity for a broad training program that may not be available in some of the smaller hospitals. So it's somewhat of a badge of courage for hospitals to develop specialty, subspecialty training programs like pediatric anesthesiology. And at the same time, they want to develop those programs. Having one or two trainees makes it very difficult to offer a robust training program that meets all the requirements of the residency review committee.
So, Dr. McManus, I think you only looked at inpatient procedures. If so, why did you exclude ambulatory pediatric procedures? And do you think those are they presumed to be so low risk and therefore kids don't really benefit from specialized care? Or was it just because of the databases that you used?
Well, we looked at inpatient procedures because, as I mentioned earlier, we've been studying the consolidation of pediatric hospital care for some time. And we think that hospitals capable of admitting pediatric and medical and surgical patients play a critical role in the healthcare system, and their numbers are declining, and we think that this is going to be important in the future. We certainly think that ambulatory surgery is very important. It just wasn't our question for this particular work. But with regard to ambulatory surgery, my understanding is that adult outpatient surgery is expanding, but reports that I've seen from Florida and California and elsewhere suggest that pediatric outpatient surgery might be concentrating, much like what we saw here.
So, Dr. Schwartz, you talked a bit about, you know, sort of minimum number of cases required and how that may be problematic if we don't know what that is, and about these smaller programs that may not be able to offer a broad or swath of different kinds of surgeries or depth of, you know, numbers of those cases. Does the ACGME have requirements for training pediatric anesthesiologists? And if so, what are they?
Absolutely. The ACGME has requirements for all of our fellowship programs and specific for each individual. So the current ACGME program requirements for pediatric anesthesiology consist of two components. The first is the common requirements for all fellowship programs, and that includes, among others, focus on lifelong learning, scholarly projects, and professionalism. The second component that the ACGME defines is specific to pediatric anesthesiology, and it's focused on the clinical aspects of the fellowship program. The ACGME mandates that fellows devote a minimum of 9 of the 12 months of the fellowship to required clinical experiences. And they say that fellows need to manage pediatric patients requiring general anesthesia for elective and emergent surgery, for a wide variety of surgical conditions. And these specifically include, among others, neonatal surgical emergencies, cardiac cases with cardiopulmonary bypass employed, and congenital disorders. And the fellows must demonstrate competence in patient management and perioperative care of neonates and infants. These requirements include high acuity technical scenarios, and these are exemplified, for example, by abnormal airway management, mechanical ventilation, and vascular access. The ACGME actually publishes a list of minimum case experience, minimum case numbers, and they break those minimums in a variety of ways. They define them by age groups, by ASA physical status classification, by anesthesiology-specific procedures such as regional anesthesia nerve blocks, vascular cannulation procedures, or specific airway techniques such as fiber optic techniques in children different than in adults. The various types of surgical cases include the wide spectrum of procedures such as neonatal cases, cardiac, neurosurgical, craniofacial reconstruction. Much the same you're hearing from me that you heard from Dr. McManus as he characterized the kinds of cases that are being done in the hospitals where pediatric surgical care is being performed.
But Dr. McManus, you briefly mentioned about, you know, women delivering babies, and we know that women deliver babies in a lot of hospitals. What do we know about how procedures on neonates perhaps skews your data? And do we know anything about the availability of pediatric surgeons and pediatric anesthesiologists or the outcomes of those procedures on neonates?
Well, there's been particular concerns that neonates with serious surgical conditions who were born outside of high-capability centers may not have access to specialized surgical and anesthetic care. So we specifically looked at five representative neonatal conditions to see where procedures related to those conditions were being performed. So we looked at necrotizing enterocolitis, congenital diaphragmatic hernia, patent ductus arteriosus, gastroschisis, and tracheoesophageal fistula as representative of serious neonatal conditions. And what we found was that infants with these conditions were being born everywhere, as you suggest, but nearly 95% of their related procedures were being done in high-capability centers. The remainder were being done in the few large birthing centers that I mentioned earlier. So overall, we were rather reassured that, for the most part, infants requiring care for complex surgical conditions seem to be getting to the specialized places that routinely provide that kind of care.
So Dr. Schwartz, in your editorial, you raised concerns about the impact that pediatric surgery consolidation has on training pediatric anesthesiologists. Can you tell us why you're worried?
So information about where pediatric surgery patients are being cared for raises important questions. Will the consolidation of these surgical services necessitate consolidation of pediatric fellowships and redistribution of the fellowship training programs to match where the surgery is being done? This actually may be the force that Cladis and his colleagues suggest is needed to, quote, regulate the number of fellowship programs and positions nationally. Now, a substantial assumption exists that the consolidation of surgical services mirrors the geographic distribution of pediatric anesthesiology fellowship programs. In reality, we don't have that information. There's no information available about the matching of pediatric surgical and anesthesiology fellowship programs. The Anesthesiology Residency Review Committee believes that trainees in fellowship programs benefit from the presence of other trainees in compatible fellowship programs, and this encourages a formative clinical learning environment and promotes an environment of inquiry. The ACGM requires pediatric anesthesia fellowships to be sponsored by institutions in which there is a core anesthesiology residency. Identifying overlap between high-capability pediatric hospitals where fellows in pediatric and surgical specialty train and the nearly 60 United States pediatric fellowships in pediatric anesthesiology fellowships may give us a clearer understanding of the intersection of these learners in the setting of consolidation. It's desirable to have pediatric surgeons train with pediatric anesthesiologists in a similar training program in the same institution. We don't believe that's happening, and it's a great opportunity to look at this and figure out where the best place to have the fellowships is.
But I'm puzzled particularly by what you said about the ACGME requiring pediatric anesthesiology fellowships to be sponsored by institutions with a core anesthesiology residency. I mean, if we're developing all of these specialized pediatric hospitals, is that possible?
I think it's certainly possible. The training of pediatric anesthesiology fellows is more robust in an environment where anesthesiology education is also robust. And usually those kinds of training programs exist in the high capability centers that Dr. McManus has talked about repeatedly. The concentration of programs for training in the place where there's concentration of care can only benefit the children.
So Dr. McManus, can you tell us about the Children's Surgery Verification Program that you discussed in your paper? What impact has this had on the distribution of pediatric surgical services?
Sure. The Children's Surgery Verification Program is an initiative from the American College of Surgeons that was aimed to promote high-quality pediatric surgical care across the country. And through its Optimal Resources for Children's Surgical Care statement, the college defined the resources and processes that it felt was necessary to deliver excellent surgical care to kids. So now, with its verification program, it has a mechanism for individual institutions to demonstrate that they have those resources and processes in place. So increased regionalization would be a predictable consequence of a program like this. So we used data from the year immediately preceding its implementation. And that way, our study can provide a baseline from which to measure the program's future impact on regionalization and access. It hasn't really been going long enough yet to be able to see what that full impact is going to be.
Is there anything bad about specialized care for a vulnerable population like children?
Well, there's certainly nothing bad about specialized care for those who need it. And when it comes to pediatrics, I think we all want kids to be in the most capable hands possible, even for small things. But there are some challenges that come as regionalization intensifies. The most obvious is that we need to ensure access to capable care when most kids don't live near children's hospitals, and the vast majority are taken to their local hospitals for urgent and emergent conditions. A second but related access challenge is more artificial than physical. As pediatric surgical care becomes increasingly concentrated within a few centers, we need to be sure that these centers are included within insurance networks and referral patterns, especially for disadvantaged populations. And then a third, more theoretical set of challenges arises from complexity theory, which teaches that complex systems become fragile when increasingly dependent upon individual elements. So anyone working in a large children's hospital can tell you that crowding and surge capacity and daily competition between surgical and medical demands are frequent problems. So as pediatric healthcare becomes more and more dependent on just a few places, we need to make sure that those places stay healthy.
Dr. Swartz, it seems to me that over the last 5 years or so, pediatric anesthesia has become much more popular as a fellowship choice. I know you mentioned that there are some programs that are going unfilled, but do we have the right number of fellowship-trained anesthesiologists currently? What are the jobs prospects or limitations they face, and do we have the right number of opportunities to train pediatric anesthesiologists?
I wish I had specific answers for the very important questions you just asked. So when I read Dr. McManus's work, I realized that the benefit of the study that he's done, it brings into the forefront the question of what really are the right number of pediatric anesthesiologists that must be trained and available to care for the children. The data from the investigation by Dr. McManus is really a great impetus for us to look carefully at where pediatric surgery is being done, what volume of patients will need care. defining the locations for care and the number of patients needing specialized pediatric anesthesia care will assist in the alignment of trainees and needed future practitioners. Another confounding issue is the ever-increasing subspecialty trend. Second-year fellowships in such areas as pediatric cardiac anesthesiology ask the same questions. How many of the specialists should we train? Where will they best be needed for patient care? And again, we don't have the answer. But coupling information about the consolidation of pediatric surgical care with our training program needs will make a big difference in how many future pediatric anesthesiologists we need to train, and we can attract them or advise them about where they can go to practice.
Yeah, because I suspect that there's still a fair number of people practicing pediatric anesthesiology today who never did fellowship training. But they're at some point going to age out, correct?
I would think so, and I think it's not only aging out, but earlier in this conversation, Dr. McManus pointed out that less and less pediatric care is being done in the general hospitals. So I remember when, many years ago, any child who fell off of the jungle gym and broke his arm was taken care of in the community. And now, for a whole variety of reasons, the community orthopedic surgeons are not willing to care for those children anymore and send them immediately to a more specialized pediatric center where the pediatric orthopedists take care of those children and the pediatric anesthesiologists can also cater to their specific needs.
It's interesting. I've been, you know, hearing from a lot of my younger colleagues and friends who have children that even general pediatricians are much more likely to refer young children to a specialist for even the most minor issue, you know, for allergy testing, to a cardiologist to check out maybe a murmur, or, you know, it seems that we are just really increasingly becoming a sub-specialized society of delivery of care.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting if I reflect back to when I started anesthesiology training. In 1973, the anesthesia residency was 2 years long, not three as it currently is. And in those 2 years, we were expected to learn everything about anesthesia care, and that included care of pediatric patients, cardiac, neurosurgical, and the like. The explosion of knowledge, techniques, medications, pharmacology, the whole gamut of what we do has really made it somewhat difficult for even a three-year residency to provide all that's necessary. So the idea of subspecializing and having people who say, I want to take care of children only or cardiac patients only, and they immerse themselves in training in that particular area, maybe that's a good thing. And maybe they don't have to learn the other areas in as complete a way as we used to think they needed to. So again, we're back to specialization provides an opportunity for people to become familiar with techniques, routine, and that provides better care, whether we're talking about children, adults, one subspecialty or another.
So Dr. McManus, do you have any thoughts or recommendations you want to share with us about what you think should be done to both ensure adequate access to the best pediatric surgical care here in the U.S. and maintain adequate and appropriate training opportunities for both anesthesiology and surgical pediatric specialists?
Well, that's a pretty tall order. what Urbano and I tried to show here was just that pediatric surgical care in the U.S. is very, very highly regionalized right now, and perhaps a lot more regionalized than non-pediatricians might have imagined. And, you know, as we've been talking about it, there are definitely many, many good things about this, but it does decrease options for training and options for practice. And then also, you know, if regionalization is only to be a good thing, then we think that there's some additional considerations that we have to have going forward. First, as I mentioned, we need to be sure that remaining sites of care stay viable. Second, we need to be mindful of potential access barriers that might be due to distance or payment models or referral patterns. And then finally, as pediatric specialists and people working in pediatric hospitals and the hospitals themselves need to build tight connections with non-specialists who are on the front lines in the smaller hospitals so that kids are safe wherever they touch the healthcare system and always have ready access to the care that they need.
I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read these important articles to learn more. Thank you, Drs. McManus and Schwartz, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.